We head into the weekend with South Dakota Arts and Science. From SDPB, today is Friday, May 16th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, groundbreaking cyanide research out of SDSU. Ellen Kester reports on how a poison Agatha Christie used to get rid of so many characters turns out to have a fundamental role in normal cell function in the human body. Then, music from Black Hills singer-songwriter Abby Leach. Plus, we head to a frog pond near Rockerville with Corey Cavell. We will howl and chirp along with the natural world as we learn about the performance art of the Black Hills teacher and poet. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It is a poison that shows up in murder mysteries and spy novels. Agatha Christie used it to kill off 18 characters. But new research coming out of South Dakota State University shows it's naturally occurring in the human body. So why do your cells make cyanide? Brian Logue is one of the top cyanide experts in the country. He's also department head of SDSU's Department of Chemistry, Biochemistry, and Physics. He spoke with SDPB's Ellen Kester from our Janine Basinger studio at SDSU in Brookings.
My entry point was when I was in the military. I was doing research at the an Army lab that was the only lab in the U.S. that could do work with nerve agents and mustard agents and cyanide and chemical warfare agents, basically all consuming. And so I was working on some nerve agents and sulfur mustard and doing analysis to look at if someone's been exposed, how long can we create a method to analyze their blood and decide where have they been exposed and how long after they were exposed can we detect the markers of these agents. That has a lot of importance in looking at treaty enforcement and other international issues. So someone came to me and asked me, hey, can you develop a method for this metabolite, which is a metabolite of cyanide. And a metabolite is just what cyanide transforms into in the body. And so we ended up creating a method, and it turned out to be a very important metabolite. And then over the years after that, that paper got cited quite a few times, and then we started getting funding for cyanide analysis and looking at treating cyanide and developing methods for those treatments. And we've been basically doing cyanide analysis, cyanide research for 20 years or so by now. That is where we kind of became known as the cyanide analysis guys here at SDSU.
You fell into it much like some people accidentally fall into murder. Can I make that comparison?
Can you accidentally fall into murder? I don't know. I always think about there was a murder in Purdue or a professor in Purdue. Mm-hmm. And one of the pieces of evidence was there was a bottle of cyanide he bought, and there was a sign out sheet. And the grad students were supposed to fill out how much cyanide they had taken out of the bottle. And there was more cyanide out of the bottle than was supposed to have been taken out by the grad students. And I'm like, I am never having a sign-up sheet because grad students are terrible at signing out things. And so people would look at that bottle and go, oh, what are you using this cyanide before? And I'd be like, no, it wasn't me.
So no sign-up sheet because you're afraid you might get accidentally... I would charged be with murder.
I would be accidentally implicated if something happened around me, yes.
So how does cyanide kill?
How does cyanide kill? Well, it is very attracted to iron in your body. It likes to bind to iron, and it just so happens that iron is a part of what's called the heme A group, which is the final step in aerobic metabolism, which is really important for our body. So it's basically how our body uses oxygen to create energy so that we can, you know, live and function. And so if cyanide's in your body at a level above a critical level, it will bind to all these slots where oxygen should bind to. And so if you have all these cyanide binding and oxygen just doesn't have a place to go, and even though you have a bunch of oxygen in your body just can't use it. And so you end up dying from that, not being able to create energy. And so you end up in cardiac arrest is the final outcome of too much cyanide. Now, there is cyanide in our body at low levels all the time, which we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. But a lot of what we thought it was from was diet mainly. But it is produced naturally from amino acid metabolism.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a spoiler. So yeah. I want to ask about...
I jumped ahead.
You jumped ahead. So you just said that the assumption was the cyanide was coming from diet. Is that from like apple seeds? Where do we get cyanide in our diet?
Yes. Peach pits. apple seeds, like you said, but just generally, cyanide can be produced from, you know, it's a common group on molecules. So in the digestive process, you can produce cyanide from that digestive process. Now, they used to have back in the age of Rome, they'd call it the penalty of the peach. So basically, they boil up a bunch of peaches and give someone accused of a crime a drink of this drink, and of course is one of those things. If they died, then they must have been guilty, and if they didn't die, then they must have been innocent. But it's really just how much cyanide was in those peaches that they were boiling up, those peach pits. And actually almonds as well, they always say cyanide smells like bitter almonds. And so that's kind of partly where that comes from. Bitter almonds are very heavily, they have a high amount of cyanide in them as well.
So how many peach pits would I need to eat to die? Like how much cyanide does it take to kill a human person?
How much cyanide? I don't know. I can't help you out there. So I don't know if...
Oh, do you actually know you don't want to advertise this on the radio?
No, I don't know. So... I do know about 1 milligram per liter of cyanide in the blood in terms of blood concentration, because I'm more of an analytical chemist. That is a level that is potentially toxic. So if you get that level, so cyanide is obviously natural and we handle it. Our bodies can handle certain concentration of it. So it's sort of like... if you get overwhelmed, if your body gets overwhelmed, it's not so much a set amount. It can be a set amount if it's all at one time. But if it's over time, then your body can continually metabolize the cyanide and you'll be fine in the end. But if it gets over that certain amount, which correlates to this blood concentration of the 1 milligram per liter, then you can get overwhelmed, your body gets overwhelmed, and you can die from it then.
Is there any way to treat it? Is there an antidote?
Yes. So there are three main antidotes. We have thiosulfate, which helps to exacerbate the body's process to metabolize cyanide in a natural way. So cyanide becomes thiocyanate, which is a sulfur on the cyanide. And that's a natural process. That's the main way cyanide is metabolized in the body. So thiosulfate, if you add that, adds a bunch of extra sulfur to your body in a way that isn't poisonous or anything. And so with that extra sulfur, it helps to convert that cyanide to thiocyanate. There's another way, which is to create what's called methemoglobin in your body. So we all have hemoglobin. We kind of know what that is. But if you add sodium nitrite and you take that as a treatment, then what happens is the hemoglobin converts to another molecule, which is called methemoglobin, and that has a high affinity for cyanide. And if that will bind the cyanide, then the cyanide gets sort of bound there and doesn't go to the mitochondria where it interferes with the oxygen utilization in the body. And then the other way, the other approved antidote is cobalamin, hydroxycobalamin, and that is sort of a vitamin B12 analog. But basically it does the same thing as the methemoglobin, where it has a high affinity for the cyanide itself as well. And so it will bind the cyanide, and then you basically, the liver then detoxifies that compound. It'll bind again, it'll bind that instead mm-hmm. of the iron in the mitochondria.
Okay, so if someone, if you're listening to this interview with someone and they seem like a little too into it, maybe you should go get some B12 vitamin supplements.
For sure, for sure. And then part of our research has been to find each of those antidotes have their own issues, mm-hmm. and especially in a mass casualty situation where there's a number of individuals that have been exposed, say to say there was this sarin Tokyo subway incident back in the 90s. There were actually cyanide devices in the bathrooms that didn't get deployed, but they were there and they were going to be part of that attack. Mm-hmm. So if there's a number of people exposed in one area, each of those antidotes that I talked about have their disadvantages. Part of our research has been to look for other better antidotes and to really help those who are doing that drug development along the way.
So now let's get into your research. Our cells can produce cyanide.
We, of course, all think of cyanide as a poison. We in the cyanide research area have known for quite a while that plants use cyanide as a signaling molecule.
Okay.
And also bacteria will generate cyanide. And we've thought mainly that that was used as a protecting, a way to protect themselves. But it's also, I think, been found that that is also used as well in signaling. And so it followed that we felt that cyanide would also potentially be used as a signaling molecule in mammals, so in humans as well. What we did is what we looked into that, and we've seen, you know, low levels of cyanide. I've always said in all my talks, we all have cyanide in our blood. Straight out, we all have it at some level. It's always there. And so it makes sense that the body would use it for something if it's always there and not this exogenous thing that you take and then you're poisoned with, but it's always there naturally, whether it's diet or something else, the body you would expect would use it. And what we did was we found that it does use this as a signaling molecule. Cyanide does like to bind to proteins to modify the proteins and do a post-translational modification that then signals to other proteins and other molecules that, okay, this is something that we should do. And so we narrowed it down to different, how does cyanide get produced? We narrowed it down mm-hmm. to different amino acids. And the one we figured out that really produces the cyanide is glycine. Glycine's a pretty small amino acid. There's 20-ish amino acids that we have in our body that make up these proteins. And so we found glycine, and glycine metabolism was something that then produced cyanide at low levels, ended up being important for biological processes. So there's a metabolic process that the glycine goes through that then converts it into cyanide. And then that cyanide can be used as a signaling agent. And we're just starting in this research. Mm. So there there's a whole world that this sort of opens up to explore as what are the important downstream effects of cyanide and what is it signaling along the way. So we, of course, we don't have all the answers, but there are a few things we can say, okay, cyanide, high levels of cyanide. And when I say high, it's not up to a poison level, but high levels of cyanide might do this or it might do this. And what we can do, because we know glycine is important, is look at if someone has trouble metabolizing glycine or someone has just a very easy ability to metabolize glycine, mm-hmm. what downstream effects does that have? And then we can say, well, is cyanide important in that process?
What is the cyanalyzer? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, the cyanalyzer. So it's a technology we developed along the way as we mm-hmm. became, again, the cyanide analysis guys here at SDSU, that we wanted a diagnostic technology to detect cyanide levels in blood within a very short amount of time. People know about cyanide and know about cyanide as poison, but also one issue with cyanide is that it's in fire smoke for building fires. It's a high component of fire smoke, so HCN is. So firefighters are very concerned about cyanide because, of course, an occupational exposure mm-hmm. risk is there for them. So what we wanted to do was develop a diagnostic where we can take a small amount of blood and then determine the level of cyanide in that blood. And if it's above a certain level, then we could say, okay, you've been exposed to cyanide. So this cyanalyzer we developed maybe in its final form, or well, it's not final form, but its current form, mm-hmm. maybe about 5 years ago is probably where we got to this form. And so we use that technology along with an extra step, which is using a very high-tech instrument to look at even lower concentrations of cyanide than we can analyze via the diagnostic. And we looked at that to look at these small concentrations of cyanide in the tissues and mm-hmm. Cells to be able to detect it and to be able to say, okay, these concentrations are there. And then when we add some glycine to these tissues, it spikes up the cyanide amount.
So how exactly did this discovery change our thinking about cyanide? Like, what is the whole new world that it has opened up?
One of the first, nitric oxide was one of the first small molecule signalers in tissues and the body. Before then, it wasn't thought of that small chemical molecules could be signalers or important in biological processes. Everybody was thinking it was these big, large proteins and enzymes and these really large molecules. And these small molecules don't, they're just there. They don't really have any so much importance. The nitric oxide discovery won the Nobel Prize for creating a whole new area of thought in that in biochemistry, basically. And then along the way, we found also that hydrogen sulfide, so H2S, another very small molecule, similar to cyanide actually, is also a signaling molecule. There's another one that I'm forgetting, and then cyanide now has joined that group of small molecule signalers. So if you know that something is important in a biological process, you can do a couple things. You could either enhance it if it's a important biological process that you would like to enhance that's advantageous, or you can try to get rid of it, reduce it, if it's a deleterious effect. And so if we want to get rid of it, we can add some of these scavengers that we talked about, like mm-hmm. hydroxycobalamin, to bind the cyanide. And then if there is or this buildup of cyanide a person has, there's a potential to treat them if it's causing issues. There's a potential to treat them with these binding agents, and they'll bind the cyanide, and then cyanide won't be able to do the disadvantageous thing that it's doing. We could also use, there are some drugs that produce cyanide, very small amounts of cyanide as well. And so if we found that there was a disease disease state that someone had, that it would be actually advantageous to have a small amount of cyanide injected in their body, then we could add these treatments that actually generate cyanide, and that might help them out.
That's Brian Logue, head of the Department of Chemistry, Biochemistry, and Physics at South Dakota State University in Brookings. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We have a conversation with poet Corey Cavill coming up, but first, music for your Friday. Abby Leach is a singer-songwriter in the Black Hills. I spoke with her in March as part of our spotlight on emerging performing artists. Let's begin with an in-studio performance.
This is my newest song. It's called Goodbye San Francisco. I hear my train a-coming down, and it seems to me that it's 2 whole hours later than I expected it to be. Looking from the last car, I had hoped to see you gone. Goodbye, San Francisco. I wish we got along. Goodbye, San Francisco. I'd still surely like to be a place where outside my own window I can look out at the sea. It's hard to be somewhere where fog is thick and wind is strong. Goodbye, San Francisco. I hate to say so long. A target backs of those free spirits who'd escaped to a world where art and music and performance have a place. I never saw myself as a personality. Goodbye, San Francisco. I'd wish you'd marry me. I'm headed towards Midwestern states with an old-fashioned charm. I've never been this eastern, but in trying, what's the harm? Disappearing into the vast landscapes of brown. Goodbye, San Francisco, you're really not my town. I'll tell them I'm confused or that it's insincerity. Goodbye, San Francisco, you and I could never.
Let's talk about songwriting and the process for you.
Most of the time when I start a song, I mean, I just kind of like sit down with my guitar and I start playing a little bit. I usually write like the chords and the lyrics and the melody all at once. And I think it's best to try to just finish a song in one sitting. I don't always do that, but if I have to come back to it, it usually doesn't go very well.
Really?
Yeah.
So then does it come out in one... Like, what's your revision process? Like, get the whole thing down in one setting is what I'm hearing you say, but it's not done then, is it? Or is it?
Most of the time it is. Sometimes
really?
I'll add a little bit, but the problem is I don't know how to revise. So if a song is basically not as good as I think it can be the first time, then I pretty much just don't play it for people. So I probably need to figure out how to do that.
But what you do know how to do is trust the process of getting it all down. And some people can't do that. So how do you trust that artistic voice that says, I'm just going to start going? And are you recording yourself then?
Usually I'll like write a verse and record it. And then, you know, write a chorus and another verse, record that.
I love that. I love that. Everybody has such a different process. It's kind of fun to hear that out. That's singer-songwriter Abby Leach. Find her music and performing schedule online. She is at Abby Leach Music on Facebook. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Corey Cavill is a teacher, songwriter, gardener, and nature lover. She's also a performance spoken word artist. She invites listeners to join her in a playful space by a frog pond. Cavill stopped by SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
1997 is when I got here. My husband at the time was working for the Forest Service, and he came back to the Black Hills, and I grew up in Montana, and it was quite a surprise to be in South Dakota, and I didn't know if I was going to find a place here, but I'd already started writing songs at that point, and out on the muddy Cheyenne, fishing one day, I found myself understanding that it was really okay to be here, and that muddy river really was an invitation. It really called me, and so that started my relationship with this place.
And what were you resisting? Were you homesick?
Well,
was it something about here that repelled you? What was the resistance coming from for you?
I think it was the idea. I always thought I would be in Montana as a fifth-generation Montanan, but I immediately felt a kinship with the Black Hills and the different waterways that came through here and the different animals and birds. And so they've really helped me navigate this story of mine that it continues to unfold. And now I find myself, I did not stay in that marriage and left it with two of my children. I only have two children. And the journey continued, and I was Corey Tompkins, and then I turned into Corey Tomovic. And then I continued to write. Because life is difficult.
Yeah.
And you play many, many roles in life. I've been a teacher. I work for South Dakota Specialty Producers and did education projects across the state with local producers. I have been a business owner and remarried. And all the way through that, it was writing and songwriting that helped me find meaning along the way.
Tell me a little bit about this moment where you're kind of looking through all your files of writing and your binders and seeing and looking for patterns, looking for themes. Were you intentionally looking through your work trying to say, what's in this for me today? Or was it like a random thing where you happened to be flipping through things and you saw something emerge? And it was this encounter with creatures from the natural world that struck you. Take me to that moment and tell me about it.
Well, it was actually a pretty dark moment, I think. It was pre-menopause, menopause, post-menopause. It was empty nest, all mixed in at one moment. And I thought I had lost my voice. Truly, I didn't know. Why am I still writing songs? Is there anything in this? And I just started looking at that. And I also revisited a book. And it was Clarissa Pinkola Estes, Women Who Run With Wolves. And she basically said, hey, wake up. There is not a human on the planet that doesn't have this moment, this existential crisis, where you have to reclaim the pieces of yourself that you've put on a shelf.
Yeah.
And I go, okay. And her first chapter was called Howl. And it's actually about losing your bones, losing what is the most central to you. And she suggested going out and howling. Well, I didn't need to be invited twice. And every full moon, I'd go out on the deck, and this is a true story, with my dog. And we began howling with a very specific intent to retrieve the pieces of ourselves well, I say ourselves, because the dog did really help me write that melody, the pieces of ourself that we put aside.
Yeah.
And so I started howling. And within a couple years, really, I started to really look at the things in the binders, on the shelf. And there, lo and behold, was an entire show, which I call Welcome to the Frog Pond, because that's where I started. I started on a small place in western Montana, and I grew up beside a frog pond.
Yeah.
And that frog pond, the people were always kind of crazy. You know, there was always arguments and there was stuff going on. But if I walked outside into the frog pond, there were turtles and there were snakes and there were crickets and there were snipes. And they told me that it was pure magic to be alive. And I was a part of something so mysterious and so grand that it really was my home.
There's something very physical about going outside and howling.
Yes.
Through the throat, through the, you know, through your gut, through everything. And you said you didn't need to be asked or invited twice. But for people listening, some people might be like, that's weird, or that feels uncomfortable. For people who are like, I don't know if that's right for me, why does the physical action matter to you? What would you bring back from the other side to say, you might want to give this a shot, even if in a different way that makes sense for you, of that physical vocalization of what's happening inside? You see what I'm asking there?
I do. It's about longing. And I think longing is in our feet. It is in our bones. And when I do this show, it's like the second or third piece that I introduce to the audience, and I have them remember something that they long to do, or somehow it got misplaced, and I just have them remember it. And then I make them all howl. And you know what? They don't have to be asked twice either.
They're all in, yeah.
They're all in. There's something about pre-language. You know, when I hear coyotes out on the hillside, and I imagine they're just getting together to have a little party, and there it's about the communal experience of being alive. And so when I'm howling with people in the audience, it is communal. It's pre-language. And sometimes I think language is so inadequate. So inadequate to the understanding of this mystery we are all in. And I think the howl really helps, actually.
How do you, as an artist, as a performance artist, set the stage and create a space of safety and inclusion so that people can go on a journey with you?
Well, I do set it up. I introduce the piece, the whole show, with a recording of a real frog pond. And that was recorded in Rockerville, South Dakota, at the Grover Frog Pond. And I stuck my microphone out in the middle of that pond. And I try to remind people of the mystery of encounters they have out in the woods, or moments from point A to point B where we're going, what am I going to do next? And there is a moment of clarity that I think we all have in living, that we get outside of ourselves. I think often it is an encounter in the woods with a storm or with a bird that starts to sing in the middle of winter when you come outside and there's a chickadee. And it's the coldest day of the year, and yet the chickadee is incredibly loud and beautiful, and saying, I'm still alive despite it being 20 below and there's a blue sky. So it's going to sing.
Tell me about the moment of finding the frog pond in Rockerville, because if you came from this frog pond and then were you looking?
Oh, when I hear a frog pond, you know. I stop.
You know.
I just stop. And they're because they're just waking up in the spring, and I can't help myself.
Yeah. So the show is poetry. How do you describe the show to people?
You know what? I've never seen anything quite like it. Because I don't want the audience to clap. I want them to chirp, and I want them to hoot, and I want them. I think it's just a remembering for all of us. Or at least that's what I'm trying to get them to remember and to pay attention to the magic of the environment, the ecosystem that we're all living in. And we all have an ecosystem inside of ourselves that if it's healthy, we can hear things. We can hear each other. And so it's a remembering.
Yeah. So the influence artistically, poetry, folk music, nature sounds, what else?
Oh, my beloved artist, Mary Oliver.
Yeah.
She just traipsed out in the woods with her little notebook and her pencil, and she gave all of us permission to go there and interact with the world around us.
Yeah.
But always folk singers. There's, you know, I did the folk for 10 years. We did the writing workshop intensive for a full week all around the Black Hills, but mostly out in Nemo, the Nemo Guest Ranch. And we had Ann Hills. We had Tom Paxton. We had Steve Gillette, Cindy Mangson, Linda Waterfall, Bob Franke. And the Black Hills Songwriters, I was a part of them for 10 years, and it just became so wonderful to meet other songwriters and to keep writing. But the organization was a little bit taxing on me, and I finally just needed to do other things and kept writing.
You take the show to different towns across South Dakota, do different towns, provide different audiences, and what do you receive as an artist from the audience?
Oh, we're all in this together. I get to go to Watertown May 28th and Sioux Falls June 3rd and back to Pier on June 5th and then to Brookings on the 8th of June. I think it's the commonality, it's the communal experience of listening to each other, but also there's no technology except for the microphone. Mm. And I think there's a disconnect that's going on in our society right now. And I want connection. I want to see people's eyes, and I want to see them smile, and I want to laugh. And I really miss that. And that's what I'm searching for, I really believe.
Yeah. Do you have a preview for us? Did you bring something to read or perform?
I brought a few things.
Oh, wonderful. What would you like to begin with?
Well, I'll start with this one, because one of the questions in the show is, if you were a flower, what would you be? And it's taken a long time for me to really accept the brain that I have, which is full of ideas, and it's always popping off, and sometimes I'm a little misunderstood, I think. Mm. So this is called, well, I won't tell you the name. You'll figure it out.
Okay.
I have long been misunderstood, but really, I'm very good. You like to think of me as your foe. Please, just let that go. So many things to worry about. Why bother me when I pop out? I'm as cheerful as the morning sun. Why not join me and have some fun? I'm a dandy. I'm a dandelion. I'm a dandy. I'm a dandelion. And that might be a problem for you. But really, What can you do? I'm a dandy. I'm a dandelion. Stop calling me a weed, when really I'm everything you need. You spray that poison all over me, but you're killing yourselves. So just let me be. I'm good in a salad, tea and wine, but my root, it is divine. If I had a voice, I would sing, I'm the cure for everything. I'm a dandy. I'm a dandelion. I'm a dandy. I'm a dandelion. And that might be a problem for you. But really, what can you do? I'm a dandy. I'm a dandelion. Inflammation? Constipation? Who needs all that consternation? Is your blood pressure too high? Darling, you should give me a try. My root goes deep into the soil, gathering goodies so you don't have to toil. You can't see what's right in front of your face. A problem is the solution to heal the human race. I'm a dandy. I'm a dandelion. I'm a dandy. I'm a dandelion. And that might be a problem for you. But really, what can you do? I'm a dandy. I'm a dandelion. And my babies, they love flying because they're dandies. They're dandelions.
Thank you so much for that. I just love it when I hear something I've never heard before on the show. I've never heard
Thank you before.
You were fresh and you were new. I love it. Thank you for that. Give us another one, if you would, please.
Okay. Well, I start the show with one in the darkness, because that's where everything good begins. And this actually happened to me. I was out camping and heard a few owls talking to each other. And I decided they wanted to be a part of the show. I heard an owl out in the night, before the morning, before the light. Who are you? Who are you? I told the owl, I do not know. I'm still searching, up high and down low. Who are you? Who are you? Can you sit in the darkness and not know the way? Can you ask the question and wait for the day? Who are you? Who are you? I heard an owl out in the night, before the morning, before the light.
You mentioned Clarissa Pinkola Estes earlier in our conversation. I'm wondering if you listened to her audio.
I've listened to one of them.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah.
She talks about being a medial, which means being between all things and paying attention to those spaces. And that makes a lot of sense to me.
There's a patience to her delivery that I think your delivery evokes. And it's from a storytelling tradition. Do you come from a storytelling tradition? How did you find your voice, your performance voice?
Well, it's a good question. Back in the near the frog pond of my youth, I came from two very different people. And my father always called himself a hayseed mm-hmm. out from the prairie in eastern Montana. And Mom was raised with vocal lessons and also ballet. And she always had the big musicals playing out in the barn when we were cleaning the barn, you know, Fiddler on the Roof and Bally High.
Yeah.
And so I knew all the songs to those big musical productions, and my dad always watched Hee Haw on Wednesday night. And so I guess that's, if anything, those were in my bones.
Yeah.
And we always went dancing at those little one-room schoolhouses. But I didn't really consider myself a songwriter, a storyteller, until I came to the Black Hills. And the first day I got here, my mother-in-law at the time knew I was trying to write songs, and she handed me this paper clipping about Anne Hills being in Black Hills State. And so within a week, I was sitting in a classroom learning that, oh, this is who I am. I'm a songwriter. And then when I started doing Frog Pond, it was an expansion of how I see myself. Yes, songwriting is storytelling. But Dorothy Rosby came to one of my shows, mm-hmm. and she invited me to come to the Black Hills Storytellers. And so there's an expansion of how I view myself. Yes, I'm a songwriter. But at the root level, I tell stories.
Yeah.
And that gives a whole new understanding of how I can perform these things. I don't have to have a guitar behind me. I don't have to have any instrumentation. I can learn how to tell this story of my life in a new way, and that is terribly exciting.
Yeah. Is there healing in the telling?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's an acceptance of the whole life and the ups and downs and the turns on the river.
Yeah.
So, yes.
And the healing in the listening and chirping along.
Yay, yes.
We are going to leave, as we close today's show, we're going to leave listeners with a little bit of your Frog Pond, which we have played a little excerpts throughout our interview here, but we'll close the show with the Frog Pond. Corey Cavill will put links up to the performances on our website at sdpb.org. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much.
That is our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us at SDPB. Thanks for listening.